You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kēsta tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rā 2 Tuesday. I'm your host, Kester, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Faith. He whāia kēnei coming up on the show for Dear Science this week. Our expert Professor Alan Blackman chats with us about characterising liquid carbon, Antarctic base cleanup, and plants making their own pesticides. In our weekly catch-up with the National Party's Tom Rutherford, I ask about new investment in tourism marketing and New Zealand's recent sanctions on two Israeli ministers. I also speak to professional teaching fellow at the University of Auckland, Simon Schofield, about the proposed sick leave changes and how they could disproportionately affect women. Faith, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Emeritus Law Professor Jane Kelsey from the University of Auckland about ACT's Regulatory Standards Bill and whether the party should progress with it after it failing three times. I also spoke to Labour Zubair from Aotearoa Free from Stalking about the gaps in the anti-stalking bill.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or ai mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kawa e warawara e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakihere rokiroki mārunga i te pai tukutuku o Erirangi Poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more as always by podcast on the 95BFM website 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Yes, and we've got plenty of science planned this week with Alan in this afternoon. Good afternoon.
And in a packed program today.
Well, it is packed, right? Well, we're talking about...
I didn't know that before.
It's on
Dear
order.
Science. Oh. Thanks to me.
we'll pretend that didn't happen.
Right.
A bit packed, as I was saying, because we're dealing with a matter of density, right? Or pressure here, certainly.
Well, pressure, certainly. Temperature, yeah. All those good
sorts
of things.
With creating some liquid carbon.
Indeed. This is interesting stuff. So, we've got 118 elements that we know of on planet Earth. And of those 118 elements, you know, basically all of them can exist in either solid or liquid or gas forms, okay? Those are our three sort of states of matter that we all recognize. So, for example, you can make nitrogen, you can make solid nitrogen if you cool it a long way down. You can make liquid nitrogen, which probably people have seen. You can have gaseous nitrogen, et cetera, and you can do that with all of the elements. Mm. So of all of the elements, the one with the highest melting point, now there's a good quiz question.
Yeah, well, I know the answer because I worked it out this morning, but if I had to guess, I probably wouldn't have said carbon.
No, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And if you look online, you'll see that tungsten sort of supposedly holds the record for being the highest melting element. Yes, that's very possibly true, but we're talking sort of very high temperatures, and that starts becoming difficult to actually measure these when you're talking about 3,000 degrees Celsius there or thereabouts. And in fact, carbon itself doesn't melt if you just keep it at atmospheric pressure. It sublimes,
yes.
Which is the same thing that dry ice does. It
right.
goes from a solid
straight
to a gas without going through the liquid. So in order to make liquid carbon, you've got to pressurize it. And fairly high pressures as well. And so provided that you're under pressure, then the melting point of carbon is roughly 3,500 degrees.
Okay. Hot.
Hot,
and
yes.
Are these pressures, when we say pressures, is this something we can find naturally on Earth?
No.
No.
Maybe in the Earth's interior if there were any carbon there, which there isn't.
Yeah.
But, you know... That's the temperature that you get to, about 3,500 degrees. And that's sort of a bit of a problem because what the hell are you going to store this stuff in? because most you know,
and if it has pretty the much everything else is going.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Pretty much that's everything fun. Else is going to melt at that temperature. So
what do we store it in?
Well, that's the problem. It's right. not like you're going to be able to make a cup full of this stuff.
No.
Okay. So what? So this sort of piqued the interest of a bunch of scientists from all around the world, predominantly in Germany. The leader of the study is Germany, but from Europe, the UK, USA, Korea, and Japan. And they've been interested in this idea of liquid carbon. You know, the fact that it's very, very difficult to make and even more difficult to sort of characterize. And so they've found a new way to do this. And the way that they do this is by, as seems to be everything these days, using an extremely high-powered laser.
Right.
Extremely high-powered laser that delivers very, very short pulses of extremely high energy. Okay,
so
they're firing this at a carbon target, a graphite target.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and these pulses, when they hit the graphite target, they create pressures of over, and again, blows your mind, over 1,000,000 atmospheres. So 1,000,000 times atmospheric pressure.
Unimaginable, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's being generated in this tiny, and you know, we're not talking a big, you know, sample, and this is a tiny, tiny part of this, you know, graphite surface.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 1,000,000 atmospheres when these things, these laser pulses hit, and they get up to temperatures around about 7,000 degrees Celsius, okay? So the combination of this very, very high pressure and this very, very high temperature means that you form liquid carbon, okay?
Incredible.
Now, this doesn't hang around for long. This doesn't hang around for long because as soon as it cools down, which it will if the laser pulse stops, it's just going to solidify again, okay? So we're talking a few nanoseconds. So liquid carbon gets formed for a few nanoseconds, okay? So a nanosecond, remember, is a thousandth of a millionth of a second. There we go.
Got it. Okay. So it's barely any time that we're actually dealing with.
It is, not a long time. So, great, you're generating liquid carbon, but then how the heck do you know that you've got liquid carbon? How do you then characterize that?
Yes, okay? Right.
And the way that you characterize this is by using X-ray pulses of even shorter time.
Got it.
Okay, so we're talking nanoseconds for the amount of time that the carbon hangs around. We can then utilize X-ray pulses 100,000 times shorter than this. So we're now in the femtosecond.
Well, the femtosecond
regime.
That's a new word for everyone out there.
Cool word.
So a femtosecond is 1,000th of a 1,000,000th of a 1,000,000th.
Got it.
Wow.
Of a second.
So okay. Barely any time at all.
Oh, that's very quantitative. I like that. Yes. Exactly.
Is it even time at that point?
Yes, you are. It's a very, very short period of time.
Not a lot.
But the shortest period of time is way, way, way shorter than that, supposedly.
So we've still got a fair way to go.
We do. So they managed to hit it with these X-ray pulses. And from the way that the liquid carbon interacts with these X-ray pulses, they can then figure out basically what it looks like structurally, okay? So carbon itself, we think of diamond, hopefully. Okay, and diamond has a very particular arrangement of carbon atoms. So you get one carbon atom in the middle, and every carbon atom is attached to four other carbon atoms. And every carbon atom that's attached
then
to is four others.
So you get
this gigantic three-dimensional infinite array of all of these carbon atoms, each one of which is attached to four others.
And it looks really nice.
It does. It looks beautiful. Yeah. Yes. And the thing about liquid carbon, now, the reason why solids are solids is because the atoms can't move.
Right.
Okay, so they're stuck in a particular place.
Yep.
They can't move. Liquids are liquids because the atoms can move around. They can move around to a certain extent. And so that's where you get liquids from. Mm-hmm. So you'd sort of expect that liquid carbon, sort of the atoms would be free to sort of move around each other, which they seemingly kind of are, but they still seem to be associated. Each one of them seems to be associated with four other carbon atoms.
Interesting.
Okay.
Right.
And so, and this is what's been predicted by calculations as well. They sort of plug this into a computer. They say, right, what should liquid carbon look like? Computer says, whatever. You go and do the experiment. You find the experiment agrees with the calculation. Everyone's happy. And so they spent an awful lot of money on this. This is high, high, high energy, high cost science. Mm. and you sort of think, well, you know, why bother? Well, one of the reasons is that it is thought that in the interiors of some of the big planets out there, Uranus and Neptune, for example, it's thought that they may have liquid carbon in their core.
A bunch of it.
So where Earth has iron, they have carbon. And that could be contributing to their sort of physical behaviours. So, you know, all of the magnetic fields and stuff like that that we can measure, they may well arise from the presence of liquid carbon. So it's important that we can generate this on planet Earth and figure out what its properties are and then see how they...
Understand how it influences those planets.
Absolutely, okay. So so that's the story of liquid carbon. Mm. And I think it's, you know, it's kind of cool. And again, the paper that's just been published and, there'd have to be 100 authors, I'd say, on it. Probably just you know, running down the author list. So this is you know, high-stakes science.
Yeah, it's big work.
Yeah.
This next one, Antarctic base cleanup. That happened under our watch, right?
Yeah, and this is really nice. So this comes from NIWA and the University of Canterbury and the University of Waikato. And so the question then becomes, so you are down there in the Earth's most pristine environment, and what you find is that the research base that you built initially quite a wee way away from a lovely lake in the dry rivers area of, the dry valleys area of Antarctica, is in fact in danger of flooding because of temperature increase and therefore increased ice melt, and this lake is getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And so this is a place called Lake Vanda, okay? And as I say, it's in the dry valleys, which is a weird place in Antarctica. It's, as the name suggests, the driest place on Earth. You know, it's the driest desert on the planet, which is weird because they've got a lake there, but, you know. And so... there was a research station built there in 1968 and specifically to study the dry valleys. And as I say, it was built quite a wee way away from the lake, from the shores of the lake. And this was occupied every year up until 1992. But in 1992, the lake had sort of encroached to within about a couple of metres of these buildings.
Which is quite worrisome, right? That means the lake was expanding
way quicker
than they thought.
And so... in 1992, so there were 17,000 person days of sort of occupation of that site, which is the equivalent to 46 years.
Wow.
Okay, 46 years of habitation, basically. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine in 46 years of habitation, there's an awful lot of waste generated.
Yeah.
And so that waste has to go somewhere, obviously. So what they then did in 1992 was they closed the base, and then they figured, oh, you know, well, we're going to have to take all of this stuff away as well. We basically can't leave this all here. So we have to remove contaminated groundwater. We have to remove contaminated soil to leave this place pristine, because we do not want anything getting into these absolutely pristine, pristine lake. And so this was done. So 400 kilograms of water and 7,000 kilograms of soil.
Wow.
Were removed.
Massive undertaking.
That's a big,
especially
in that environment. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's logistically going to be difficult.
They just took it off on a boat or something.
Yeah, and you can obviously only do it in summer months, you know, because it's kind of dark the rest of the year. And so that was shipped back to Scott Base, and it was treated and disposed of, okay? And this was all sort of, you know, post-1992. And so they've done a study now of the former site, which is now, in fact, flooded.
Yeah.
Okay, you can see online.
So the lake's even bigger. That.
So, And so this was, as I say, work done by NIWA and folk at Waikato and Canterbury. And so they've just published this, and basically what they're saying is that, this was a success, you know, that the remediation process did manage to get rid of all the nasties. There appears to be no contamination in the pristine water. And I guess this just goes to show that when we really want to do something, we can do it, you know. Nothing is too big a problem, provided that you've got the resources to throw at it, I'd say.
Especially on that pollution front, right?
Yeah. And, I mean, this is always going to be a problem, well, you know, for everything down down Antarctica. You know, your Scott Bases and your McMurdos and, you know, the big, you know, there's lots of people there and everything. And you think about the amount of waste, et cetera, that's generated there. And obviously, there seems to be a pretty good method by which all of this is treated and remediated. And, you know, hopefully they're not making too big a mess down there, which is good to hear.
It's great news.
Yeah.
And then this last one, plants making their own pesticide, but there's seems to be a catch.
Well, you know, if you want to know about biological warfare, go to nature, you know, because they're really good at that. So you've got, you know, certain insects that contain, you know, nasty chemicals that deter other ones. And plants, probably the best of them all. So plants, you know, they're basically stationary objects, aren't
typically,
they?
Typically don't want to be eaten as well, right, I'd imagine.
They're sort of a non-moving target, yeah, shall we say, really. And so, you know, how do plants defend themselves? What can they possibly do? It's not like they can run away or anything.
Yeah.
So therefore, they have to rely on biological methods. Mm. And this involves essentially production of particular molecules that predators or potential predators find either distasteful or downright toxic.
Right.
Which will kill them. And so there's, you know, this has been known for many, many, many years that all sorts of plants use all sorts of different molecules to be able to do this.
I mean, isn't that how we get some of our funny tasting foods?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and against particular predators, you know, they're very, very, you know, the molecules are aimed specifically at particular species and stuff like that. So there's a molecule called isoprene. And isoprene is ubiquitous in nature. It's generated by quite a few plants. Most importantly, isoprene is the precursor molecule to things called terpenes.
Terpenes.
I'm not sure if you've heard of terpenes, but they are a massive class of chemicals. So there's around about over 30,000 terpenes known. And examples of terpenes include steroids.
Oh.
So they are generated ultimately from this isoprene
molecule.
You can
tell it's a word we both knew.
Been gymming, huh? Natural rubber, for example, is also derived from isoprene. It's a terpene. For those of you who like your beer, the flavour of hops.
Oh, we know that.
comes from,
yeah, we're getting
comes
to the
from,
easy one.
From
yeah.
terpenes,
yeah.
Which are all derived from this molecule called isoprene.
Yeah.
Okay. So it sounds like isoprene's a pretty good thing.
Yeah. Okay? Sounds great.
Yeah, absolutely it does. And one of the things about isoprene, I'm not sure if you've been to the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia.
No, I haven't.
I tried. Tried to drive down the Blue Ridge Parkway, but it was closed at the time, which sucks. Or have you been to the Blue Mountains outside Sydney?
I don't think
My God, come on, people.
That's closer
travel,
to us.
For goodness sake. So the reason that these have their... Well, why do they call them blue? Why are the mountains blue? Mm. You know, and the answer, again, is this molecule called isoprene.
Interesting.
Because the trees are basically emitting this molecule, and it just gives you this sort of blue haze. And that's why they call them the Blue Mountains and Blue Ridge, et cetera, et cetera. And so, again, you think, right, this is good. This is natural stuff.
Isoprene sounds
all good. And what they've just found is that in addition to being the building block of these really, really important biochemical molecules, it's also now been shown to deter insects.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting. They just sort of really hadn't looked at this. And so it looks to be used in defense, in plant defense. And so they've done some studies, basically. They've done some experiments and they've taken insects, they feed them on plants that either don't produce isoprene or do produce isoprene, and they obviously go for the ones that don't produce isoprene, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of this good stuff. So it's basically shown that, it seems to be a molecule of defense for certain plants. And the really interesting thing is that some plants, like soybeans, for example, it was thought that they didn't emit isoprene.
So they're easy targets then?
Well, not necessarily, because when they're under stress, they can emit isoprene. So they don't normally do it, but when they're stressed, they can. And so this was a big sort of discovery as well. So you've got some sort of dormant gene there for the production
it's
of isoprene.
Very impressive.
And so basically what this looks like is that we might have a nice, abundant, natural insecticide that's going to deter predation, you know. So we could utilize that as humans, crops and stuff like that, you'd think. But here's the kicker. And here's the sort of demonstration that if something's natural, it's not necessarily good for you.
Yeah.
Okay? So isoprene is the second most abundant molecule that is put into the atmosphere, hydrocarbon molecule. So the most abundant is methane. We all know that that's bad for
the atmosphere. Not great.
Okay. Isoprene's the second most. And again, that's not great for the atmosphere either, because it reacts with ozone.
Right.
And we don't want the ozone layer getting any thinner.
We kind of like it.
We do kind of like it. So basically what we've got here is a situation. We've got lots and lots of trees. You'd think planting trees is a good thing. The more trees, the better. Yes, to an extent.
But
because they're taking in CO2, but they're also emitting, or some of them, not all of them, they're also emitting this isoprene molecule. And so that's not necessarily a great thing. So we're sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place here. And what you want, obviously, is the balance.
Yeah.
You want to find that right balance between the number of plants that are taking in CO2 and utilizing it in photosynthesis, as opposed to the number of plants that are emitting this isoprene molecule and potentially damaging the ozone layer. So, nature is all about balance.
Yeah.
It really is, and I think that's nicely illustrated here.
Yeah. And a fun little story of, we find out about this new insecticide. Sounds great. We could use it everywhere and then,
Except.
But it's still very interesting how it works. Incredible
really cool
stuff. Yeah. Thanks for sharing these really interesting science stories this week with us, Alan.
Always a pleasure.
As always, thank you, Moshat, and thank you, science. We're going to play the second half of the outro now. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
The Auckland Philharmonia is doing another performance of that famous guy's music.
Who?
You know that guy? Ba 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 ba.
Oh, he looks kind of grumpy in that painting.
Beethoven!
The Auckland Philharmonia plays Beethoven's iconic Fifth Symphony at the Auckland Town Hall, Wednesday, June 25th at 6:30. For tickets and more info, go to aucklandphil.nz.
Ow, my back!
What happened?
I slept on the floor.
Why?
I don't know how to wake up on the right side of the bed. Is it my right side or my left side?
Always wake up on the right side with the 95 BFM wake-up call. Tune in at 7:25 on Breakfast with Johnny for your chance to win a voucher for 6 coffees, thanks to Atomic. Just text the word Atomic and your B-card number to 5395 to go in the draw.
The 95 BFM wake-up call, thanks to Atomic Coffee Roasters.
It's music.
95 BFM.
Broadcast to the world and podcast to your device. Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
I'm not gonna die on this hill, or maybe I will. Summer's over, it's sad, but I'm still been in bed. Can't keep calling it grief, or hoping it's brief when you live in the world. But I live underneath, who will water the plants? Are they just gonna be another thing that dies from spending time around me? I got heartbreak for jet lag, and you got free. I got heartbreak for jet lag, and you got free. wanna move on. I got heartbreak from Chitlin' and you.
I got heartbreak from
Chitlin'
and you.
I got heartbreak from Chitlin'
and you. I hope that you are looking out in nature, climbing, having some solar time if that's what you need, and staying sober, or at least sober now. Please take care of yourself. I love you. I'll see you soon.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Tom Rutherford.
Welcome back to The Wire. Last week, Tourism and Hospitality Minister Louise Upston announced plans to double tourism value by 2034, with increased funding to support the country in reaching this goal. The funding is targeted primarily at increased marketing of New Zealand tourism overseas, which has been met with mixed receptions from tourism operators in Aotearoa, many of whom have been struggling with existing tourist numbers. Also this past week, the New Zealand government imposed sanctions, including a travel ban on two Israeli ministers for inciting extreme violence against Palestinians. While the move has received cross-party support, opposition parties such as the Greens and Te Pāti Māori have criticised the government for not taking further action against Israel. In our weekly catch-up with the National Party's Tom Rutherford, I spoke to him about each of these issues, starting with the increased tourism funding. We've seen some new announcements and plans for tourism in Aotearoa. What is the new funding that the government is allocating and what is it going towards?
The government is investing $35 million in 2025-2026 to deliver the first stage of the tourism growth roadmap, which supports economic growth and sustainable tourism. This includes $13.5 million for Tourism New Zealand's marketing in Australia, the United States and China, which is expected to attract an additional 72,000 visitors and generate about $300 million in spending, $6 million to grow tourism demand in emerging markets across India and Southeast Asia, $3 million to support more business events through Tourism New Zealand and business events industry, $5 million in additional funding for the Major Events Fund to attract and support high-profile international events, and $4 million to improve visitor experiences and reduce congestion along the Milford Road corridor.
Yeah, I wanted to address some of those latter points. There's been some concerns for tourism operators in Aotearoa, especially in the last couple of years, where we've seen increased promotional funding, that the domestic infrastructure isn't there to support increased travel. How is the government also going to be investing or providing for our domestic tourism industries to support more visitors?
Yeah, so that was a great question, and that leads into a lot of the work we're doing around things like our roads of national significance. The 17 of them that we've got rolling out across the country, we've got two in my local patch in the Bay of Plenty. They provide a great opportunity for people to travel domestically on safe, fast, good high-quality roads so they can get from one place to the next place quickly and safely. And so having things like roads of national significance are really important to our local tourism and domestic travel so people can get from one place to the other place a lot quicker.
Yeah. Some of our biggest attractions in Aotearoa are our geographic features and wildlife. We've seen discussions by this government around reducing environmental protections or considerations in legal processes and proposals for mining on conservation land. Are we undermining our national tourism interests with these changes in other areas?
Absolutely not. We can chew gum and walk at the same time. We know, for example, the previous administration's decision to ban oil and gas exploration actually had negative impacts on New Zealand because what happened? We imported dirty Indonesian coal in its place. So what we're saying is we can have some mining in New Zealand, but we can also protect our clean green image across New Zealand and across the world that we're so proud of and which plays a massive part as part of our draw card to come to New Zealand for many, many tourists. So it is possible to do both at the same time, uphold high environmental standards in New Zealand whilst also still attracting people from overseas. Got to remember our growth roadmap, which we set out, has three main targets. Increase the number of international visitors to at least 2019 levels by 2026. That's 3.89 million. Double the value of 2023 tourism exports by 2034 from 9.9 billion to 19.8 billion. And grow the number of Kiwis in tourism and hospitality jobs.
Next, I wanted to move on to the government's recent sanctions on two Israeli ministers. What are the sanctions and why have they come about now?
Yeah, alongside Australia, Britain, Canada and Norway, we've imposed new sanctions against two extremist Israeli ministers, one being the finance minister and one being their national security minister. We've taken these measures due to the fact both ministers have advanced extremist rhetoric, promoting illegal settlements, calling for Palestinians to be driven from their homes, and encouraging violence. Their words have escalated in an already horrific situation and are specifically designed to prevent the formation of a Palestinian state.
Green Party co-leader Chloe Swarbrick has been pushing for economic sanctions on Israel since December of last year, criticising the government for imposing less sanctions on Israel than those placed on Russia for its invasion of Ukraine. Would the government be supportive of economic sanctions on Israel moving forwards?
Yeah, so the part you're talking about with Chloe Swarbrick, that's Chloe's members bill, which is sitting in the members bill ballot. And the National Party caucus will consider her bill, which is called the Unlawful Occupation of Palestine Sanctions Bill, if it's drawn from the ballot. But it's important to note that New Zealand does not conduct foreign affairs through members' bills.
I guess the point that I'm getting to here is that Chloe is pushing this bill due to its importance and its significance, not only for the people of Palestine, but also the importance of New Zealand upholding its identity as an upstanding nation on matters of human rights. If it's such an urgent matter, should the government be considering it with more priority than if it were drawn as a private member's bill?
Yeah, so we've already taken a number of actions as a government. We designated Hamas as a terrorist entity in February 2024. We've provided over $17 million in humanitarian assistance to Gaza since October 2023. The Foreign Minister has repeatedly called for immediate ceasefires and condemned the humanitarian situation as intolerable. We joined 23 other countries in demanding Israel allow full humanitarian aid access. We've constantly called for compliance with the UN Security Council resolutions demanding an immediate ceasefire. And we've opposed Israel's expansion of military operations and called for meaningful steps towards a two-state solution. We are playing our part in the global settings of what is taking place here, and New Zealand is doing absolutely our bit to uphold what we expect to see as a resolution between the two between Israel and Palestine.
On the two-state solution, which I understand is the New Zealand government's stance for the solution that we support moving forward, is the New Zealand government prepared to recognise Palestinian statehood at the present?
Yeah, so our position has always been that we will continue to advocate for meaningful steps towards a durable two-state solution as the only path to find lasting peace in the region. We've also talked about our condemnation and our focus on a humanitarian focus, but on the two-state, we've always advocated for a meaningful, durable two-state solution.
Right, but talking about recognising Palestinian statehood right now, currently New Zealand does not recognise Palestinian statehood and Palestine is an independent state. Is that something that the government is looking at doing at the moment?
I'm not aware of the government looking into that. That's not to say that it's not potentially taking place, but I'm not the Minister of Foreign Affairs, so I wouldn't be privy to that sort of information, but I'm not under the understanding that that's currently being considered at this time.
All right. Lastly here, I wanted to talk about New Zealand following the United States. There's been some accusations that New Zealand has been, I guess, treading carefully around the matters of Israel and Palestine due to the fact that the United States has such interests in the area and has a clear foreign policy stance in the area. What would you say to these accusations that New Zealand is not acting on the situation due to its ties to the United States?
I would say those comments are completely unfounded and not made of any basis. As I outlined earlier, when we imposed those new sanctions on the two extremist Israeli ministers, we didn't do it alongside the United States. We did it alongside Australia, Britain, Canada and Norway. New Zealand will always look out for what's best in our interests as a country, whilst also working closely with our ally partners across the globe.
That was the National Party's Tom Rutherford speaking to me about the upcoming tourism funding and New Zealand's sanctions on two Israeli ministers.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Tom Rutherford.
This is why we should never put celebrities in charge of any... Oh, wait.
The Wire.
The government has also discussed potential changes to how sick leave is allocated, scaling sick leave days with the amount of hours a person works. While this wouldn't affect the 10 days available to full-time workers, it could see part-time workers with reduced access to sick leave. This has raised some concerns around disproportionate outcomes for women and students, two groups that tend to be employed in more part-time positions. I spoke to Professional Teaching Fellow at the University of Auckland, Simon Schofield, about the proposed sick leave changes and how they could disproportionately affect some demographics. So the government has been proposing some changes to how sick leave is handled in the workplace. What are the proposed changes and how would they differ from the current system?
So the proposed changes are to pro-rata sick leave. So, for instance, if you're working part-time, that you would be entitled to sick leave based on the amount of hours that you work. So, for instance, if you're working 30 out of 40 hours, then that will result in a reduced entitlement from the normal 10 days sick leave entitlement that we have now.
Yeah, and it's been said that since part-time workers are working less, they'll need less sick time days than full-time employees. How does this work in practice?
Well, this is challenging, right, because part-time employees fill a variety of roles. What I mean by that is that you can have a part-time employee that only works 3 days, but three hours every day of the week, right? So they work seven days, but they only work 3 hours every day. And therefore, you've got a part-time employee because they're working 21 hours a week. So, you know, some of that is taken into account in the calculations of how sick leave is already calculated. What the government's proposing is slightly different in the sense that you are just not entitled to as much sick leave as a full-time employee.
Yeah, and so if we're thinking about the demographics that will be primarily affected by these changes, you mentioned groups that might be working shorter hours across every day of the week. What are some of the other demographics that could be affected if these changes go through?
Yes, so obviously, and I think this is where your question is driving at, is that women. Women and students are going to be primarily affected, and that's because they're more likely to be working part-time positions rather than full-time positions. And that has a flow-on effect. So one of the other challenges with this change is that caring responsibilities, as much as we would like men to take on those responsibilities, one of the challenges is that at a society level, women are still doing the majority of caring after children and elderly.
We saw the sick leave days changed from 5 days to 10 days under the previous Labor government around the COVID-19 pandemic to account for people maybe needing to take more sick time off. Is the 10 days appropriate for everyone, or should there be more or less?
I think it's useful to compare ourselves with Australia on this issue. So Australia does have 10 days sick leave, but they also have what's called unpaid carer's leave. And this allows for employees to take some time off to look after children or the elderly, dependents, and that may serve as a useful framework moving forward. And I say that because the assumption is with our current sick leave regime that it all needs to be paid. And just having the right for employees to apply for unpaid carer's leave may be useful to ensure that obviously children are looked after and the elderly are looked after.
Yeah, so what kind of changes would you advocate for if you were in that position of governance, or if you were advising on this sort of issue? What kind of changes to the sick leave system, or would you leave it as it currently is?
Look, businesses have articulated their concern about the increase from 5 to 10 sick leave days. So clearly there's a concern there. I just think that if we're going to adopt the Australian system, Certainly in respect of holidays generally and accrual, we would be wise to enable carer's leave, and it's certainly unpaid carer's leave, as a solution to the government's idea of having sick leave prorated, because that will ease the effect of these changes on those marginalised groups without costing the government a thing.
That was Professional Teaching Fellow at the University of Auckland, Simon Schofield, speaking about the proposed sick leave changes and how they could disproportionately affect some demographics.
The Wire.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM.
Apart.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. The ACT Party has unsuccessfully tried to pass legislation for the Regulatory Standards Bill three times. Academics such as Emeritus Law Professor Jane Kelsey believe that they should not progress a fourth time round. Regulatory Standards Bill, can you tell me about your position on it?
This is one of the extreme attempts by the ACT Party over the last 25 years to seize the reins of lawmaking in Aotearoa, dictating what the value should be, what the processes should be, and putting in place their priorities on wealth and private property at the expense of te tiriti o waitangi, social considerations, the environment and much else.
And why do you think the ACT Party are still progressing with this bill despite failing twice?
The ACT Party has a fundamental ideology that it is wedded to. Its original name was actually the Association of Consumers and Taxpayers. It began work with what was then the Business Roundtable in the 1980s, trying to develop what they called an economic constitution for New Zealand, which meant that there would be a straitjacket that would apply to government that advanced the particular objectives of the ACT Party. And it tried three times to get this through Parliament. It failed three times, and this time it's managed to get a commitment from its National Coalition Party partner to pass this through the back door of the coalition agreement that they did. So unlike the Treaty Principles Bill, which was a similar stitch-up between National and ACT, where National only said they would support its introduction and passage to select committee, in this case, National has said that they will support the legislation of the bill based on previous versions that ACT has tried and failed to get adopted.
Are there any relevant past examples other than this bill where parties have still progressed with passing legislation despite them failing their readings? And if so, can you tell me about what should have been learned?
Well, this is unprecedented in the extent to which a failed bill has not only been resurrected, but unless National and New Zealand first, one or both, vote against it, contrary to their coalition agreements, it will actually pass. So this creates a terrible precedent for what can be done under supposedly more accountable MMP systems through coalition backdoor deals. In that sense, we need to be concerned not just about this instance, but about the precedent that it creates in legitimising that kind of practice.
Do you see this bill dividing the coalition government in any way?
There has been a groundswell of opposition to this bill from many, many quarters, from Māori who see it as a rerun of ACT's rejected Treaty Principles Bill, from lawyers and legal advisers who say that supposed principles of regulatory standards that it's introducing are an aberration designed by ACT for its own purposes. Even people in the business community are very concerned because it will stop much needed legislation, for example, it will impede much needed legislation to break up the monopoly powers of the supermarket chains and the banks and the insurance companies and the electricity companies and so on. So there is a groundswell of resistance to this, which ACT is simply ignoring.
Before we wrap up the interview, is there anything else that you'd like to add?
The National Party has made a commitment in the coalition agreement that it will support the passage of this legislation. New Zealand First, in their coalition agreement with National, has said they'll support what National has agreed to with ACT. Both of them are on vote losers if they support this, because there is such widespread opposition from all quarters to this. hopefully they will see the light. Already in the responses to the discussion document, only 0.33% of submissions supported in whole or part the passage of this. So the ball is now in the court of National and New Zealand First to both see sense and to protect their own electoral base.
That was Emeritus Professor Jane Kelsey about ACT's regulatory standards bill being unsuccessful three times.
And I wish some of your dozy mates in the media had got a fix on their job and started being reporters and journalists, not editorialists and analysts, which they're not qualified to do. Prison company accepted, of course.
The Wire.
Although the anti-stalking legislation has been praised as a step forward for women in New Zealand, activists have deemed the bill the bare minimum and believe that some grey areas haven't been addressed. Community worker Laiba Zubair from Aotearoa Free from Stalking believes that the bill needs to be modified to be more victim-focused and that police need to be better equipped to deal with cases of stalking. While the anti-stalking bill has received significant positive feedback, what are some criticisms that it's received?
So we have been in constant contact with Minister Goldsmith, and some of our key kind of concerns are that, firstly, we don't think that the law will be able to keep stalkers who lie to account. It doesn't really do that, because it's a tricky thing of, you know, how do you even produce evidence that someone knows their behaviour is likely to cause fear or distress if they lie? You can't. And we need to be able to say that she never replied to his multiple texts until they got threatening, and then she replied to de-escalate. And so it's difficult because he, you know, it's a difficult one of having to prove that his behaviour was unwelcome. And the law doesn't really cover that scenario. That's my kind of point that I'm wanting to make, that she did not engage, rather than she told him no in uncertain terms at this point. The law needs to keep the onus on him rather than her, and that's not how the law is set up at the moment. Another kind of key thing that's missing in the law is that it doesn't include a requirement to ensure that victims have a safety plan in place before the police contact the stalker. So right now, the way the law is set up, the police can contact the stalker and let them know that a complaint has been made against them, and the victim or the complainant would have no idea. And that is really, really harmful, especially in instances of domestic violence and interpersonal violence. And that's sort of another one of our big key concerns with the bill. Overall, it's a decent bill. Like, I'll be honest, it's the bare minimum in many ways, and it's a good starting point, but a lot of our work is to make sure that the implementation of it is good enough for it to work. Otherwise, there's no point.
And what are some other ways that the bill can be modified to be more focused on protecting the victims?
Yeah, the two kind of things that we're focusing on, because, again, we've been in contact with Minister Goldsmith, is the victim notification and the area for stalker misinterpretation, where the bill doesn't fully address cases where stalkers are delusional or misinterpret their behaviour as acceptable.
Do you think that the police are currently too lenient with stalkers?
I think the police are not well-resourced enough. The police need to know how to gather evidence for stalking, and police need to take victims and survivors seriously. And, you know, if that means public awareness campaigns of what stalking is, that could maybe mean having real victim support, even possibly a hotline, because one of the biggest gaps right now in resourcing is that, say you want to report sexual violence or you need support for sexual violence, you can find hotlines for that. There are helplines and hotlines for domestic violence. There are helplines for many things. But the question we're asked a lot is, if I'm being stalked, who do I contact? And the answer is that we don't have one singular one that we can tell you to do and to tell you to contact. And so one of the biggest gaps there is that people don't feel safe enough to report to the police. And so if the police do something along the lines of, you know, including or introducing a helpline that is purely on stalking and on reporting stalking, that would go a long way, the way we see it, in building that trust between reporting and the community, because as it stands, there is a huge gap of resourcing, and the police are going to play a big part in making sure that the implementation of this bill goes well, and for that they need to be well resourced, and their training, and anyone who's in the police system, regardless of where they sit, need to be trained properly, and the government needs to be making sure that there are certain things that the police are being trained on as well.
And what are the next steps that Aotearoa Free from Stalking will take?
Look, our next steps from now are to put pressure on the government to make sure that they push out this bill properly, but also make sure that it is implemented well. The advocacy is definitely not over, and from now on it's just making sure that they don't lose the ball from here, because the government may very easily say that, you know, we've done the bill, so now we've done our job, but that's not the case. And what we're seeing from cases like the Forbes case is that we need to still push for more stronger and safer laws that cover as many scenarios as we can, because there's too many blank spots in there. And so we need to be working closely with the communities that we serve, and we need to be making sure that young people especially are educated and know what to do if they're getting stalked, or if they are, if they suspect they're getting stalked. Because in today's day and age with social media, there are so many more ways to harm and to stalk someone. And with this bill, again, it's a good starting point, but a lot of it will come down to how it's implemented and making sure that it is truly victim-centered and not just something that is thrown out there like, hey, we have these laws, but nothing is done about it.
That was Labour Zubair on the anti-stalking bill's loopholes and how they need to be addressed.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoi, kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Professor Alan Blackman, the National Party's Tom Rutherford, Professional Teaching Fellow at the University of Auckland Simon Schofield, Emeritus Law Professor Jane Kelsey, and community worker Labour Zubair from Aotearoa Free from Stalking. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.